Welcome to Questions in Sustainability, a science-based podcast series that explores programs, people, and ideas in sustainability of food systems. I am Professor Paul Vincelli from the University of Kentucky, and I'm your host today for this episode of Questions in Sustainability. And I've got a speaker that I'm quite excited about because of the work that he's doing in insect control and where it might lead. And but before I introduce our guests, I do want to say that we appreciate all of our guests who offer their time and expertise to Questions in Sustainability. And of course, the views expressed by our guests, or by yours truly for that matter, do not necessarily represent those of the University of Kentucky. So with that, I'll introduce our guest, and our guest is Dr. Russell Gross from Madison, Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin. And it's a great place. I spent 6 months there on sabbatical. Would love to go back in some capacity someday. So anyway, Russ, welcome to Questions of Sustainability.
Yeah, Paul, thank you very much. I mean, it's a pleasure to be here. And I appreciate the invitation. And yeah, I hope that, you know, most of the people that, you know, are going to hear our conversation are, you know, going to, you know, learn something a little bit about the technology maybe and maybe gain some appreciation.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll be no problem with that. Russ is a professor, an extension specialist, and department chair in, I presume that's entomology at the University of Wisconsin. Is that right?
Yes, Paul, that's right.
Okay. And interests include vegetable crops, integrated pest management, insects in relation to plant disease. Yay, go disease. Well, not really. We want to control disease, but we're excited about it. And resistance management. And I think by resistance, you're referring to resistance against insecticides.
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. So, Russ, before we get into your particular interest, tell us something about your history, or, you know, so the listeners can know a little bit better who you are. How did you get into this area that we're going to talk about?
Well, I'm hoping you'll appreciate this, Paul. I, through my graduate work, I had always worked primarily on the relationship of microbes and insects.
Oh, yes.
So, in an earlier time for me, in my master's work, I actually worked on bark beetles that attack forest and forest trees, and the mycangeal fungal associates. These are fungi that helped the beetles overcome trees. And later I worked my graduate work when I was at NC State. I worked on an insect called thrips, and it's a really small, real small insect. And it transmits tospoviruses to a variety of different plant hosts. And so I worked on the ecology of that pathosystem. And I did a postdoc in Ithaca, New York, and I worked on the transmission of a potato virus by aphids. And then my first real job after being a postdoc was in Central California. I worked on an insect called the glassy-winged sharpshooter, which transmits a bacterial pathogen called Xylella fastidiosa to grapes and almonds. This is Pierce's disease in grapes, almond leaf scorch in almonds. And so then I came to Wisconsin. I've been here at Wisconsin about 17 years in my current position. As you said, a research and extension faculty person. My extension responsibilities are for vegetable crops. But our research in our lab still focuses on the ecology of vector-borne disease of plants. So we actually work on virus transmission. We work on the transmission of plant pathogenic bacteria, specifically a phytoplasma called Aster Yellow's phytoplasma. And then, as I think is maybe a little bit of the focus of today, we work on insecticide resistance management. And resistance to insecticides, specifically within insects. And again, the technology that we might center on today, you know, was kind of born out of you know, our efforts to better understand insecticide resistance.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. That your background is really quite fascinating to hear about because of my interest in microbes that affect plants as a plant pathologist. And in, for the audience, we often in plant pathology refer to good or great diseases. And I suspect the same is true for insects. And we don't mean good in the sense of, wow, look at all the, you know, the human suffering they cause. But in a way we do. It's like a good disease, a good insect is something that is worth the time to study, to try to control. But is also very fascinating in how it causes so much damage. So you've worked with a long list of pretty, good infectious agents and microbes and insects. So
yeah.
So how the topic that caught my attention, the reason I contacted you to be on Questions in Sustainability, is that you're working with a technique called RNAi or gene silencing. I'd like to maybe just turn it back over to you to give the listeners some explanation of how that works before we talk, about some of the bigger issues relating to that.
Yeah, no problem. I mean, the concept of RNAi or RNA interference is something that, has now been, described for on the order of, 15 or 20 years. I mean, some of the seminal work was done, quite a number of years ago, but it's really based on a more complete understanding of some of the mechanisms by which eukaryotic cells, and we're eukaryotes, insects are eukaryotes, the mechanisms by which the production of a protein or the translation of a protein is shut down. I mean, you'll remember, the podcast is a great venue, but this is where a picture is worth a thousand words, but we're going to do our best to, to navigate that space without a picture. But you'll remember that, when we produce a protein, in a cell, the first thing that happens is that, the template of that protein has to come out of the nucleus. Remember, DNA always stays in the nucleus, and what is coming out of the nucleus is messenger RNA, and that's in a single-stranded form. And so messenger RNA goes to the ribosome, and of course, at the ribosome, it gets translated, right, into read as codons, or, three sets of nucleic acids, to produce an amino acid. And that amino acid, starts to, those come together structurally in the form of a protein. And so once you read that long messenger RNA sequence, arguably you've created the protein that the cell is interested in, translating. Well, there has to be a mechanism by which the cell says, I've got enough. And so that is a mechanism that's called post-translational gene silencing. Now, this happens in us, and it happens in every eukaryotic cell, only a million times a day, so to speak. But the mechanism, of course, is also based on the fact that these single-stranded RNAs, nucleic acid doesn't want to always be in a single-stranded form. Oftentimes, they'll turn on themselves and make what we call a hairpin, which is a double-stranded form of that RNA. And so when the enzyme Dicer is the name of the enzyme in the cell starts to see large numbers of double-stranded RNA, it becomes the signal. It becomes the sort of the signal that says, oh, I think the cell has produced enough of this protein. So when the cell sees a large number of messenger RNAs that are folded back on themselves in the form of a hairpin, creating a double-stranded version, then this enzyme Dicer runs up, cuts it up into little pieces, and loads it into something called the RNAi silencing complex, which is a nice name for just a mass of proteins that grabs those small segments after it's been cut up and then runs around the cell looking for like pieces. And of course, it's going to see other single-stranded messages coming out of the nucleus. And when it finds those, it It uses this guide strand in the RNAi silencing complex to match up to it, and it cuts it, and it starts cutting up the RNA out that's coming out of the cell. So effectively stopping the process of translation. That's what we would call the endogenous, or meaning internal, the endogenous mechanism, post-translational gene silencing that shuts down, the production of a protein. So,
This is a very natural process, is what you're saying.
This is what happens, right? This is what happens in us. This is what happens in every organism a million times a day when, this is the stop machinery. Mm. This is the machinery that the cell uses to say, okay, we've created enough of that protein. So anyway, as you might imagine, and what the actual signal there is when the cell sees RNA in a double-stranded form, that's what initiates the process of the enzyme called Dicer to cut it up, load it up into the RNAi silencing complex, and then go run around and hunt for, more of that signal to cleave and stop. So that's effectively, stopping or halting, what would be the production of that, gene. Mm-hmm. So of course, with that understanding, that opens a door, right? Because then if you know what the sequence of a gene is that's going to be expressed, if you can synthesize that in the form of double-stranded RNA, and you can deliver it into a cell, what is the cell's normal reaction going to be? The cell is going to say, oh, look, there's double-stranded RNA. I need to cut that up, load it into the RNAi silencing complex, and run around and shut down that signal if I can find any. So this is sort of the crux. What gene do you want to shut down in what organism?
In what organism? Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's great.
And right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's that's very nice as an extension specialist. I'm very very taken by excellent explanations, especially those that are done without images. That's a nice work. So I among the many things you said, I just want to remind viewers of the hairpin, right? And just like you might buy in the grocery store, that hairpin can, be the sort of the image that you can keep in mind of double-stranded RNA that's naturally present within a cell and becomes the trigger for the silencing of the gene that hairpin came from.
That's exactly right, Paul. So again, the question is, we've now for the last decade or more, we've compiled, millions of reads of sequences, from so many different organisms, plants, animals, you name it, bacteria, viruses, et cetera. But so in things like insects, we're getting, and in humans, but certainly in insects, we're getting really close to, having sort of these full genome sequences. And we know where genes are in those genome sequences. And we can identify that some of these genes are like critical genes, maybe for the function of the insect. So, and we know that the proteins produced from those genes are critical. They're critical for the life of the insect, or they're critical for some aspect of the functionality of that insect. So if you want to, somehow intercede, or have an effect, at least in a management context, you can identify that gene, have it synthesized in the form of a double-stranded RNA, and if you can deliver it into the cell of the insect, then the insect, the internal machinery will have no choice but to look at that and say, I have to hunt for those sequences. And so anytime then the cell is trying to produce that protein, and you can imagine sort of copious amounts of that messenger RNA are coming out because the insect says, I need it. But the internal machinery has already been sort of pre-programmed to cut those pieces up. And so again, that's what you're doing, is you're interfering with the translation of RNA or RNA interference. So that's sort of the concept. And you know, people are looking for and trying to identify, you know, what are the best targets? What are the best gene targets?
Yeah, boy, I can tell we're gonna have a lot to ask, and more than our time will allow. But that's a wonderful introduction. So, where do I go next? This is something that I truly don't know the full answer to. How do you deliver it into the cell? How do you deliver your double-stranded RNA into an insect's cell?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I mean, from an experimental standpoint in the lab, if for example, you want to, you know, silence a gene in an insect, we can do things that we call intrathoracic injections, which is a real nice name to say that we take a rather small hypodermic needle and we just inject these double-stranded RNAs, you know, into what is the open circulatory system, you know, of the insect. And then those double-stranded RNAs will be, you know, taken into, you know, the cells of insects. And once inside those cells, they'll have their intended effect of silencing the genes. Now, you might say, well, Russ, from a practical standpoint, we can't run around, you know, an agricultural field or, you know, an urban or domestic dwelling if we're interested in trying to, you know, control a pest of humans or something like that. We can't do it that way. And the answer is you're right. But it's really amazing. There are some insects, and specifically chrysomelid beetles, in which the insect that we work with, the Colorado potato beetle, is classified as a chrysomelid leaf beetle. That's just a family name for a type of leaf beetle. They actually have proteins in the wall of their gut that will take double-stranded RNA out of their diet, whatever they're feeding on, and process it and move it into the bloodstream of the insect. So mm-hmm. in all seriousness, Paul, these insects are already equipped to just eat it. Mm-hmm. All they have to do is ingest this double-stranded RNA. It's actually shuttled across the membrane of the gut and is moved into the cells of, you know, into the bloodstream of the insect, and makes its way, you know, pretty uniformly throughout the body of the insect. So in these few insect taxa, oh my gosh, it's so easy. It's so very easy. But I will say this, not every insect has, you know, those kinds of what we call transmembrane proteins, or membranes that live in the midgut lining of the insect, that do this. So it's not that easy to do it for every insect.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's not a sort of a magic bullet. It's just maybe for certain insects, but not generally.
That's right. As you might imagine, though, I mean, people are exploring whether or not, for, you know, some insects may actually have some other forms of membrane proteins that function in this way. And maybe we just don't understand it yet. Okay. Or other ways, you know, to deliver it to an insect. And there are other ways, but they involve a little bit more technical challenges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm curious, how did you, let me step away from the technical part for a minute. How did you get involved in this work?
Yeah. So I think, you know, in some of our earlier correspondence, I was telling you that part of our lab works on trying to better understand the resistance mechanisms in the Colorado potato beetle. A potato beetle is a perennial pest in, you know, in potato production. And up here in Wisconsin, you know, we grow a lot of potatoes and across the northern tier of the U.S. And I mean, there are certainly several insects that have long histories of developing resistance to insecticides. So we were trying to better understand what genes were involved in allowing the insects to be resistant to insecticides. Mm-hmm. Okay. And there could be many, many genes involved. But so we started doing investigations to look for what genes seem to be being expressed in real high numbers, you know, in the presence of a pesticide. We did that. And in fact, we found that there wasn't, you know, hundreds and hundreds, but rather kind of a discrete handful. So then we use this technique, this technology called RNA interference, to basically set up in a laboratory an assay to see whether or not the gene that you think is responsible for resistance is actually functioning in that way. So as you might imagine, we take beetles that we know have a, you know, have a high level of resistance to a certain pesticide. In advance of subjecting them to that pesticide, we feed them some pieces of double-stranded RNA that will be designed to knock out the gene of interest that we think is operating with respect to, you know, resistance. So we feed the beetles, and then shortly thereafter, we expose those beetles to an insecticide application. Now, if we don't have the right gene, then the insects come through just fine, right? They're still highly resistant. Okay. But if we have knocked out the correct gene of interest, then, oh my goodness, these beetles are very susceptible. Again, their resistance mechanism has been compromised by this technology. So that's really how we got started. We were wanting to understand what were the one or two or handful of genes that were involved in insecticide resistance. And we just used that technology, RNA interference, to sort of sleuth out or deduce if those genes are truly involved.
Yeah. Well, I think really, the next step that at least that I'd like to steer us in the direction of is sustainability questions. And it'd be interesting to get your opinion on that. But before we do, Russ, I like to take somewhere midway through or so, I'd like to take a very short break for a musical interlude. And it's just maybe it could be less than a minute. But the idea is it gives listeners a chance to refresh the mind and, gives us a little break from the topic. And we're going to just take a quick break, folks, and we'll be right back. And we're speaking with Dr. Russ Groves, a professor at the University of Wisconsin and an entomologist. And he's talking about RNA interference and a really interesting topic. So stick around. It should get even better. And we're back. And you're listening to Questions in Sustainability from the University of Kentucky. I'm Paul Vincelli, a professor of plant pathology at the University of Kentucky. And we're speaking to Dr. Russ Groves, who is a professor and extension specialist and the department chair in the Department of Entomology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Russ, it's been fascinating already, and we've got more to go. So thanks for joining us today.
You bet. Appreciate it, Paul.
So you have a wide range of experience with RNAi, and including work in your own lab and with collaborators in at least private industry, at least in some cases. So you've had quite a broad background in the application of RNAi, or the experimentation towards application. Tell us about that world.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so you're right. I mean, in the first half, we talked about the phenomenon itself of RNAi. Then we talked about how our lab got involved, and through that work and through publications, over the last four to 5 years, we have worked with some, biotech corporations and biotech companies, as they are interested in developing these kinds of solutions, and their interest is to develop these technologies, from a pest control situation.
Mm-hmm,
so,
sure.
And as I mentioned, we were trying to better understand the resistance mechanisms in Colorado potato beetle. Colorado potato beetle is a global pest. Its impact on potato is valued in the hundreds of millions of dollars every year in terms of its losses. So, I mean, it's a significant agricultural pest. The company that we started, some relationships with was a group called Greenlight Biosciences. They're out of Medford, Massachusetts. And they were interested in developing an approach for direct control of the Colorado potato beetle. So using the technology we were just talking about, mm-hmm. they went after the development of a small piece of double-stranded RNA, really nothing more than that, that was sprayable. They could spray it on the leaf surface. Yeah. And then the insect came along and just fed upon it. And then it results in a lethal phenotype, meaning it kills the insects. It's really kind of interesting, the exact nature of how it works. The gene that it's targeting is something called a nuclease, but it's a gene that is in some ways, signals to the beetle whether or not it's like fully satiated or whether it's hungry. And effectively, when by knocking out a certain gene in the insect thinks it's full.
Mm-hmm.
And in so doing, it just doesn't feed. And so insects really don't do very good for very long periods of time if they don't feed.
Yeah.
And this is effectively, how lethality results.
Wow.
They're ingesting the compound. It has this effect. It's effectively masking the insect's ability to understand whether or not it's hungry.
So yeah, that's a great approach. So one question I want to make sure I get in. If I'm in the audience, I might hear that and think, well, how does it keep me, how do I avoid harm from in my own body if I eat that double-stranded RNA?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's going back when I mentioned the fact that we have lots and lots of sequencing data. So as you probably know, scientists, when they develop sequencing data, they store that in, a national repository, that is called, sometimes referred to as GenBank, but that's NCBI. But this is what a lot of us would do is if you want to understand whether or not the piece of double-stranded RNA that you want to deliver, could have an effect on another organism, then you can query those resources and see whether or not, there are, comparable sequences, the idea being looking for non-target effects.
Mm-hmm.
And that is exactly what a lot of people are doing or trying to do in terms of investigating these kinds of approaches is they're looking for a critical gene inside of an organism that is specific only to that organism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So to be quite honest, these kinds of technologies can be customized to not only, you know, one organism, but just a specific gene unique to that organism. So from the standpoint of limiting non-target effects, this kind of technology, well, in my estimation, has extreme promise. Where have we come from? We've come from, in at least in intensive agriculture, pretty broad spectrum insecticides that just about kills anything.
Mm-hmm.
We've advanced forward with some newer biologicals over the last maybe 20, 25 years that has a little bit more narrow specificity. We're now at a point where we can design pesticides to target one specific species.
Mm. Yeah, and I know enough about the subject to know where this comes from, why you say that. It really is very powerful possibilities. You mentioned, I think, topical sprays, external sprays that are external to the plant and remain on the leaf surface and so on. And the other way that RNAi is investigated for disease control, and I think insect control as well, is engineering the plant to produce the double-stranded RNA.
Yeah.
Genetic engineering, of course, is commonly called a GMO, and there's a lot of public opposition to that technology. I have to, sort of give my maybe it's a bias, but I actually think that engineering the plants to do this, produce this double-stranded RNA, is probably more sustainable and more readily adaptable. I mean, if the pest changes, you can change the double-stranded RNA. But I'll let you talk here, Russ. I'm sort of going again on a soapbox, but it seems like the both technologies are useful, but the engineered approach seems to have its own particular strengths as well as weaknesses. What do you think about that whole topic?
No, you're exactly right, Paul. So Paul here is alluding to the fact that, you don't just, like in the case of a Colorado potato beetle, you don't just have to, spray it and then have them interact with the plant that way. The plants can be, modified, as Paul says, to produce this double-stranded RNA. And there would be value side there. There'd be a value proposition there, no question. I'll take a step back and let's go back first before I address that and say, there is also still value, at least in what we call the sprayable form, because, most nucleic acid like DNA and RNA, it doesn't do very good, outside underneath the sun. UV degradation, will degrade RNAs or nucleic acid, which is RNA and DNA. It'll degrade it really fast. So make no mistake, these technologies as sprayable technologies, there is some intellectual property. There is some, logistics and science involved in how to extend, the functionality of a sprayed RNA. But even though they're trying to do this, those RNAs in the environment do not last very long. So that's a value, I would say.
Yeah.
That's a value side of spraying it.
Yeah.
You spray it on a target, the target eats it, and then that product does not persist in the environment for very much longer.
Whereas if it were engineered, it would be in the plant protected in the plant for a longer period of time.
It would. That's exactly right. But just like in many of the GM crops that we have right now for things like BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, the protein that is in most field corn, for example, that's an insecticidal protein. I mean, the value of having the plant, be the mechanism producing that is that it can always maintain, a sufficient quantity, inside the plant, And so you do, you don't have the challenges of it washing off. You don't have the challenges of you know, degradation in the sunlight. Yes. However, the challenges, as you know, Paul, are not always, you know, biological. They might be social.
They might be social.
And, yes. And so, I mean, the public has hesitancy. The public perhaps has maybe a lack of understanding of these technologies. And I get that. And in so doing, you know, we don't see a lot of genetically modified specialty crops. We do see it in corn and soybeans and rice and cotton and wheat, but we don't see a lot of that technology in our specialty crop industries. I mean, you probably know, you're probably well aware of, Paul, that you know, some of our yellow crookneck squash has, you know, has some virus resistance. You would know the story of papaya ring spot, you know, in papaya in Hawaii.
Yes.
And these are really great examples of, you know, of, in my estimation, successes with, you know, genetically engineered virus resistance. But it kind of stops there in specialty crops.
Yeah.
So I'm, you know, there would be a lot of potential value in having the plant produce these double-stranded RNAs, in the plant. It would be a GM, there's no question, because, you know, you are amending the genome of that plant to produce this double-stranded RNA. And to that point, or to that end, it would be classified as a genetic modification or a GM. Spraying nucleic acid like we've been doing out on the leaf, you're not amending anything. So, and that's, I think, a point where the public, you know, needs to, you know, sort of have this understanding and sort of this, if you will, balance of, you know, appreciation, you know, for, you know, what's the value side of these technologies, and what are the risks? Mm-hmm. No question.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm just imagining someday maybe we'll get a chance to sit together and talk more about these topics. I want to throw in we've been talking a little bit about sustainability issues, but I really want to make sure we delve into that a little bit and hear you expound whatever your thoughts might be. You've said some of that already, but I'd like to give you a chance to speak more about it, because, you know, it is we are called Questions in Sustainability. And in fact, it's clear to me that you have thought about these pro and con sides quite a bit. So what do you think, where does this technology, RNAi, both sprayed or engineered, or mostly whatever you want to talk about, but where does it fit in a sustainability world?
Yeah, I mean, I hinted towards that a little bit. I'll make one other comment, like just thinking about this, the idea of customizing, you know, this technology to focus on very specific, you know, insects and insect targets. And remember that, you know, an outcome of that would be is that we would have far fewer, you know, non-target effects. So, and in fact, that's some of the work that we have been doing with this company, Greenlight Biosciences, is trying to measure, you know, enhances in diversity of insects. Mm-hmm. And conservation of other insects in these systems where these technologies have been used, because there is arguably no effect.
No effect because you substituted an RNAi technology, very specific, extremely specific, as compared to the use of a toxin and an insecticide. That would have possibly more damaging effects to other organisms.
Yeah, and I just mentioned that because I think that's one of the I wouldn't say it's a keystone, but I mean it's one of the keys from a stewardship standpoint. I think in terms of sustainability is, you know, we're always looking for, you know, the more, you know, ecologically appropriate, you know, kind of solution, and I think these technologies really, really lend themselves to, you know, increasing, you know, the longer term sort of ecological, you know, stewardship of, you know, agricultural environments, you know, in terms of, you know, these kinds of approaches. So, I mean, you probably aren't surprised to hear me say that, and so forth. In terms of, you know, profitability, I mean, these are not compounds that are silver bullets. This isn't something that's going to, you know, promise, you know, sort of indefinite long-term control. You know, Mother Nature always has a mechanism of over-engineering already in place. And there's been plenty of peer-reviewed work in the last few years that have demonstrated that insects can actually develop resistance to this approach. These technologies will generally just become part of our overall, you know, toolkit, is what I'm thinking. And of course, in any new, you know, new technology, new development, you know, whoever the developers are need to reap some kind of financial recovery. So I'm going to say that, you know, they probably won't be the cheapest tool in the toolbox for at least the first few years, but they will be a very valuable tool that, you know, by the nature of their use will hopefully be able to increase or at least maintain, you know, sort of producer profitability. So, I mean, as we continue to lose compounds due to insecticide resistance and others, you know, these kinds of approaches, you know, offer, you know, some longevity. So they will, you know, from a producer standpoint, you know, lend themselves to, you know, sort of that element or that pillar of sustainability. You know, in terms of just sort of the general quality of life, or, you know, and thinking about, you know, what most producers want to do. I mean, most agriculturalists, Paul, I can imagine it's exactly this way in, you know, in Kentucky as it is in Wisconsin. I mean, most agriculturalists want to leave the land that they're on, you know, in the same way or better, you know, in which they were. And so these are, again, kinds of technologies that kind of help us get to a place where we don't have to use broad spectrum insecticides. We don't have to use technologies that are potentially contributing to, you know, what we read in the popular press right now about, you know, mass extinctions, you know, global loss of biodiversity. I mean, make no mistake, I'm not suggesting that these things, you know, hold the promise for that, but I think they help us down that road. There are groups of insecticides now that are being implicated in the news and the popular press for their, you know, their effects on bee declines, bee disappearance, and, you know, overall losses again, and, you know, in insect diversity, insect numbers globally. That's actually quite scary, you know, those observations. If we can develop a technique or a technology or a set of customized technologies that only focus on one or two, you know, problematic, you know, organisms or taxa, and leave the rest alone.
Yeah,
I mean, this is, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, interesting that you bring up the insect Armageddon issue. I mean, you didn't use those words, but I've kind of stuck with those. That's actually one of my upcoming programs as well. So yeah, it's an important issue. Did I cut you off? Were you in the middle of something?
No, sir. Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think we've come to the end of the allotted time for the program. Let me just tell you one more thing about the podcast. I have developed a practice of including at the end of the podcast a featured piece of music that somehow relates in my idiosyncratic mind to the topic. And it's a way to remind myself and to listeners that the arts are a part of the quality of life that we seek when we talk about quality of life in sustainable agriculture. So, you'll hear, when this is finalized and posted on the web, you'll hear a piece of music that you know, in some way or another relates to the topic you've chosen as to me. So anyway, look forward to that.
Okay, very good. Are you, and that's fine. Are you taking requests?
I would certainly like to hear your input. Yes. it's got to be something I can use in the public domain or get permission.
Relatively. That's totally fine, Paul. I was just asking.
So. Oh yeah. Well, we'll talk about that afterwards.
Yeah.
So, Russ, thank you very much for joining us. You've been a wonderful guest and one leaving me with wanting to know more. So I hope we get the chance to share a beer or some other beverage of choice. And folks, we've been speaking to Dr. Russell Groves, a professor, extension specialist, and department chair of the Department of Entomology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. So Russ, thanks again.
Yeah, Paul, I appreciate the invitation. And again, I hope that, you know, we increase some literacy with respect to this technology and science generally.
Yes. So folks, you've been listening to Questions in Sustainability. I'm Paul Vincelli, your host. And it's a pleasure to have you come and enjoy our work. And so please come back next time.
So folks, I'm adding a short addendum here to the podcast. And the reason is, it was striking to me to see how much excitement I witnessed in Dr. Grove when he talked about RNAi technology and its potential to do good. I really felt like I could do nothing less than to pair his excellent presentation with what I consider to be a masterfully joyous tune. And the particular tune that calls me in this situation is entitled Coquette Instrumental. Coquette Instrumental. And it's being performed by the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. I'm going to play a short clip for you so you know what you're looking at, but I recommend that you purchase the tune for, it's only $1.29 on Amazon, and I have no conflict of interest with Amazon. I make no money by hawking these songs. I just think that there's some really good ones out there, and this is one of them. So like I said, the tune is masterfully joyous and worth having a copy. I hope you'll treat yourself and remember questions in sustainability when you do. Take care.